Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Nutcracker Syndrome podcast. We have another great episode. I'm excited that now we're getting kind of in this phase of the Nutcracker Syndrome podcast where I'm bringing more stories in. We have another our second, a second time visitor to this podcast, Kat. It's no surprise now. Kat and I have turned into best friends through this Nutcracker journey. We both live in the same place. We're now going and getting brunch together. We've transitioned from connecting on medical trauma and trauma bonding to now we're like legitimately good friends. So some of this, when your Kat's like on the precipice, we're what, like, I can't do math. I mean, you're like a week and a half away from your auto transplant.
10 days,
10 days.
10 day
Yes.
countdown.
I'm so excited. So Kat was with me when I was like, I think I want to start this Nutcracker Syndrome podcast. And you've been such a hype woman for me doing it. And then you've had different experiences than me. Like you did the Marcaine test episode because I didn't have that. So you've been adding a lot of value to this podcast. And today, very much the same, we decided let's do another episode just about your second IVUS experience and also what you learned from Dr. Stradel at Radiology Imaging Associates out of Denver. He had more insights to add. I also got a second opinion with him, and we both collectively love this man. So he's a very thorough individual. Yeah, he's a very thorough individual. And he also told you about other procedures you can have done in lieu of trying to avoid a kidney auto transplant, which was I found out about this after my kidney auto transplant. And if I would have known about it prior, you'd damn well know I would have actually have done this. So that's why I was like, let's do an episode on the renal angioplasty option. So, Kat, thank you for being here. This is lovely.
Thanks for having me back. It's good to see you again and be on this
Yeah.
podcast. I've listened to it. I listened to it. I mean, it's just, I mean, even though you and I have talked for hours, listening to the podcast, there's just even more information you bring to it, and you bring your expertise and your profession to it, which is amazing. So I'm just glad you've done this, because I've found a lot of value from this, and I know a lot of other people have too. So
Yeah, thanks, thanks, thanks. Look
yeah,
at
thanks for doing it.
me, pat on the back, hype me up, girl.
Well,
So, yeah.
it takes time. I
So
appreciate
in, yeah, absolutely. I love doing these episodes. Maybe it's because I like listening to myself. Who knows? Not really. I actually don't replay these back ever. But I do love teaching. I love education. I'm a professor for a reason, and I love my job. And this has just been a way for me to give back to the community in an educational space and facilitating stories now. And so you gave us a little bit of a snippet of your story in the Marcaine test episode, but there were things that you didn't speak about that I think we've kind of talked about talking in this episode. So let's kick it off. Tell us about you went and got a second IVUS slash second opinion from Dr. Stradel, Dr. Peter Stradel. I then from that and your experience was like, I'm signing up to go get a second opinion from this person as well. So tell us about that journey in getting a second IVUS, why you did it. Just start where you want.
I'm just gonna, when I was thinking about this episode and how I wanted to talk about why I even went to get a second opinion, it really came back to when I got my first IVUS. At the time when I got my first IVUS, I think with all of this stuff, and the doctors talk about this a lot, that the symptoms are really the key part to all of this, right? That these diagnostic tests can further explain why you're having the symptom, but the symptoms are really the thing that's important, because we know you can have nutcracker phenomenon, for example, but not have nutcracker syndrome. So you could have the anatomy of it, but you don't have any symptoms. The same thing is true of Mae-Thurner's. At the time I went and got my first IVUS, I was having pelvic pain, lower back pain, left flank pain, blood in my urine, daily persistent headaches and migraines, pain in my legs, and more swelling in my left leg. What would you, just listening to those symptoms, I'm sure many people would say it sounds like she has Mae-Thurner's and maybe Nutcracker syndrome, right? So then when I went and got that IVUS, I did get it with Dr. Brooke Spencer at MIPS, and she went through my, I was just like really brief, she went through a jugular entry, and I was completely knocked out for the entire thing. I wasn't awake. And when I woke, I didn't agree to get the stent ahead of time. This was just a diagnostic test. And when I came to, she, and I have the report, I went back and looked at it for this podcast. I had an 82% reduction at the iliac vein with significant distortion, reflux, all of the things into the pelvic collaterals. Okay. And I had already been previously diagnosed with pelvic congestion syndrome. So at this point, she officially diagnoses me with May Thurner's and she says, hey, a stent would be really well warranted here. Okay. Also around this time, I was toying with the idea that I could have endometriosis, right? And as we know, endometriosis has so much overlap in terms of the symptoms.
Yep.
This is a real conundrum, I think, for a lot of us in this situation. Like, I mean, maybe you've already been diagnosed with endo and you know you have endo, and then you're also getting symptoms from May Thurner's, or vice versa. I mean, obviously, I know that your order of diagnosis was the opposite, or I guess it was similar, but you had endo surgery. Sorry, that's my doorbell. Anyway, but you had
Visitors.
endo. I know I'm not just checking my
Who
camera.
brings, like, we're living in an age now where to me it's funny when you get a doorbell ringing, it's like that it's people don't ring doorbells that much anymore, I feel like.
Well, I mean, Ring, I can tell it's just a package, so that makes it easy. Anyway, so going back to this, there was this question of whether or not this could be endo, right? Pelvic pain, lower back pain. Of course, the thing that really stood out to me was the left leg pain. Like that, this screams May Thurner's, especially left leg, but could that just be coming from Nutcracker, right? Like, who knows? I think so many, I've seen so many posts or so many people being like, do I need a stent? Is this what I have? Do I treat, there's all these questions. Of course, all of those things are case dependent on the specific person. I'm just sharing my story, but I just want to say this can be such a hard decision for so many people. And I'm basically saying it was a very hard decision for me. But I've heard it echoed with other people. So I decided, like, hey, how do I make sure I don't have endo? Right? Because this is crazy, y'all. I have had pelvic pain since I was 13 years old. I was put on birth control because I had bad pelvic pain. Not a single doctor has ever said, I think you have endometriosis until the last year, when I kept going back saying I'm in so much pain. And it's just shocking to me that, I'm 43 years old and no one's ever said, because my pelvic pain, you've endo. They just said, well, that's period pain. And I will say this, I've had three kids and I got pregnant very easily, right? And so I know a lot of people who have endo have, issues with conceiving, but that's not, some statistic I read is that that's only true maybe in 60 or 70% of the cases. It's not a hard rule, but I thought it was. So I thought it can't be endo. I didn't have a problem getting pregnant. So you are the one. You are the one who kept saying, I bet you have endo. I bet you have endo. You have to see Dr. Muldoon. And I was like, okay, done. Like, I just made the appointment. It was like 2 or 3 months to get out. And during that time, I was like, what can I do to confirm? We're looking for these diagnostic tests, but what surgery do you move forward on? Do you move forward with a May Thurner stent? Do you move forward with an endo exploration surgery? We're all desperate to, I know I was desperate to feel better. I was miserable. And I think even, kind of with both those surgeries comes like a 3 to 6 month wait time for another surgery. So you're kind of playing this like surgical, like, juggling like cups full of water. Like, it's just like, you feel like a waiter and you've got like two giants, right? Which one do I want to do first? And like, you're just so desperate to feel better, right? And you're scared to make the wrong move. This is just how I was feeling at the time. Anyway, I end up going and deciding getting an MRI for endometriosis would be a pretty easy next step. Of course, not all MRIs are created equal. Not all radiologists are created equal. We know that. the first one I get comes back like inconclusive, like we don't think you have it. Of course, I was like, ugh. So annoying because you had to go. It's a contrast MRI, and I end up get there's a special protocol that's done. That can be ordered that my pelvic pain doctor ordered for me at UC Health, and it's an MRI with contrast, but they inject something into your arm that stills your stomach. It's like, if you look at the research on it, it's probably the best MRI to get for endo. And as we all know, there's no, here's something freaking annoying. There's no like blood tests for endo. There's no easy way to find out if you have endo. Like, MRIs often are kind of inconclusive. And so the only thing you can do is have surgery. It's just like so backdated. It makes me so mad when I think about the
Welcome to the world. It's so frustrating.
So That MRI came back, and of course, a radiologist at UC Health looked at it that specialized in pelvic pain, and it said, "Yes, we think you have adenomyosis. It looks like you have adeno, and you definitely have what looks like endo on your right ovary." For me, I was like, "Okay," and I really trusted Dr. Muldoon. I had that lined up. I had a surgery lined up in January already, and I just and she looked and she says, "You have endo." She looked at both of them, and I just that confidence. I was like, "I'm going to get this endo done first. You know, and I'm going to wait on the stent. I'm going to wait to get the stent." So I moved forward the endo surgery, and just I just want to say, like, about a month and a half in, 2 months after that surgery, of course you kind of have pain in the beginning, but then all of a sudden I didn't have any more pelvic pain. It was like the heavens had opened up, angels were singing. Like, okay.
I might be religious all of a sudden,
I was like, this is real. I was like, I felt like, oh my God, it was just amazing not to be in chronic pelvic pain anymore. No more lower back pain. Like,
Love
it was
that.
like the thing. I mean, some of the stuff is just, it's like unbelievably how life-changing it can be. And it can be scary in the beginning because I continued to have pelvic pain while I was healing. And you're like, oh, did I make the right choice? I'm just like naming this because it's so real. And I know other people probably like go through the same things. And they, you know, you really, I mean, whatever, you know, if you have a serious thing, reach out to your doctor, or, you know, you trust your own judgment and guidance on that. But there is this period of healing where you're just hoping, oh, geez, I hope this goes away as the actual injury. I did have endo. I did have stage three deep infiltrating endo on my colon, all over my uterus. I did get a hysterectomy. I did not have adenomyosis, which was interesting. It's like it's,
Same.
yeah, I know you had the same thing. So I think it's just, it's interesting. I mean, I didn't, I was fine with getting the hysterectomy. I did not miss my period.
Same.
I also had it up my left ureter into my retroperitoneal cavity, which I'm not going to go into that story. All I know is that it turns out I don't have endo any further up. That's all I can say. I did see some specialty endo doctor out in Oregon that does endo surgery into the retroperitoneal cavity. It's amazing how many doctors we have to go see. Anyway, and just like the little rabbit holes we have to go down just to make sure there's no loose ends. Like, hey, did I check this out? Yes, I did. Yes, I did. So, you know, at that point, I'm whatever, 6 weeks, 8 weeks out. I don't have lower back pain anymore. I don't have pelvic pain anymore. What I do have is my left flank pain has gotten worse, and my legs have gotten worse. And so that is confusing, right? Like, do I still have May Thurners if my left leg is more swollen? Like, you know, my nutcracker, obviously, like this left renal pain is really picking up, but like, is May Thurners worth treating, at least for me, if I'm not having lower back pain and pelvic pain? That's an interesting thought I had of myself because I'd already scheduled to get the stent with Dr. Spencer's office for April. Like, I think it was April. I already had a surgery date. And I was like, okay, I decide I'm gonna get a second opinion on I am a second opinion type person. I've gotten second opinions on almost everything. I know that's not always feasible for some people, but I just need that second opinion usually for me to feel more confident about things. So I got a second opinion, and they looked at the images. It was Dr. Stratil, and he was like, "I'm not certain you have May Thurners, and if you're not having the symptoms, like, I'm not sure this needs to be treated. Let's do another IVUS." And while we're in there, this is the gold now. This is what this episode is about. While we're in there, let's take a look. But you might need a balloon angioplasty in your left vein. Like,
So
and
I
then,
want to, before we
yeah.
jump into that, one thing I want to say though, kind of going back to that endometriosis chat, something I think is really powerful about putting both of our stories together is this, that all my symptoms started gynecologically. I had no idea I had these vascular compressions that were refluxing blood into my reproductive organs. So I go in and I had stage four endo, all that stuff. Get that cleaned out. Dr. Muldoon's amazing. Took the uterus. Also had to take my left ovary at the time. Not at the time. It's still gone. So, like, she reinserted it. Anyway, so she took the left ovary. What I think is really powerful about people going and addressing endo first is, like, for you went and addressed endo first, and then that's what led you to then cancel the stent because you weren't 100% certain. I went and had the endo excised. I got 1 to 2 good months, and I started having low back pain, left leg pain. still pelvic, and that's when Muldoon was like, I think you might also have May Thurner. So to me, I had already unturned the stone that was endo. I already knew I had it. I'd already addressed it in a minimally invasive surgery. So when I stepped into the May Thurner stent, I was confident doing so. So I think something to tell the audience is like, go and, if you were somebody with female reproductive organs and endo could be like, it sucks because the really only true gold standard diagnostic criteria is the diagnostic laparoscopy to go in. Go see Dr. Muldoon is MIGS trained. So she did extra 2 years of MIGS training, minimally invasive gynecological surgery, specifically for her at Vanderbilt University. Her bread and butter is endo excision. Excision is what you want, not ablation. I had two botched endo surgeries where they used ablation. It made me worse. So go do excision. They take it out at the root. They're not just burning it off. So I think for a lot of us, even on this Nutcracker podcast, when I look at my audience and the demographics, it's like 80 to 90% women that are watching the or that are diagnosed. There are men, obviously, but go in and check out endo. Is I mean, when you get a stent put in, that's a permanent decision you're making. So I felt confident moving forward, and that's why I recommended to you, hey Kat, I actually really think you should go rule in or out whether you have endometriosis. And in your case, it was good that you did because it led you to then be like, you know what? I'm going to push off this May Thurner stent. And then now let's re-enter the second opinion. Let's go do a second IVUS. And then I'll let you take the mic from here.
I want to like drop like two things that were helpful for me on the endo journey. That MRI was huge. And like, I think, and absolutely, I agree. I think like, I'm not even, I might still need to get a stent down the road. I'm not saying I might not have to get one, you know, like it could be I get nutcracker surgery and things flare up. It's not that I don't have the anatomy for May Thurners, because I do. It's just whether, if you're not having pain, do you don't, you know, you just don't treat it, right? So it could, you know, it could come up again. But just, I think that for me, the MRI is pretty non-invasive, and it helped kind of tip the scale for me to move forward on the endo. Just, but you have to have like a good radiologist look at it and have a good endo doctor look at it. So those are the things that get lined up if you're questioning this, is to get yourself a good endo doctor who can look at images and get that MRI ordered. And if you can get the protocol ordered where they steal your stomach, you can Google it. I don't know the name of it, but it's the gold standard for endo MRIs. And I think like there's actually a pretty high signal studies on it. I think it's over 90% accurate in detecting endo. So they are getting better at being able to look at it through imaging, but you have to get this, that only pertains to like that certain protocol, which isn't, you know, I had to get it at UC Health. It wasn't available at your run-of-the-mill MRI place. So you might have to go to a hospital and get it, but I think all major hospitals probably offer it. Anyway, okay, so fast forward now, I'm at Dr. Sutil's office, and how did I find him? I found him on the May Thurner's board. So not this one, but I went on there and I was like, hey, looking for a second opinion in this area. You know, who do y'all suggest? I've already seen Dr. Spencer. And then, you know, they listed, you know, a number of people. And like, and I just thought, you know, I read reviews and I thought, Dr. Sutil, I like him. I'm gonna go see him. He's nearby. Anyway, so I'm there and he's looking at my images and saying, I looking at these images, he said, I'm not convinced, you know, that you have May Thurners that severely. And I can just tell you, like, again, I had an 82% reduction. But again, it's not always about the percentages, right? It's really about the symptoms. So, and since you're not really having those symptoms, like, let's go in and let's take a look around and I'll let you be, you know, awake this time. We'll do like a light sedation so you can. There was something important about me seeing the images myself. You know, I really want to just like look at the iliac vein area when they were doing the IVUS and see how congested it was. So it was great. And he brought up this balloon angioplasty thing. So basically, what it is a catheter is guided into your left renal vein upon imaging, and a balloon is inflated at the site of the narrowing, okay, or the compression in your left renal vein where it might be compressed from nutcracker to widen it and restore normal blood flow. That's what it is, okay? And so it's something that can be easily done during an IVUS. And so basically the decision was, if he was in there and he said, it looks like you might need this, we're, you know, I'll ask you, we'll do it. And I will, you know, completely knock you out before I do the balloon angioplasty part. So we'll do it at the end so you can be awake for your IVUS imaging. So we go in, we do the IVUS imaging. I'm able, to he shows me like three times the area of Macerners and I was awake. And basically what he was showing me was while I was that I did have a mild to moderate stenosis, but that while I was breathing, it opened up really far. And that this was a very like kind of like fluid, it really responded to the respiratory phases and it really opened up. And just honestly seeing it open up so much as I was breathing in and out gave me, it just made me feel like this isn't a static situation. It's not stenosed. Things are still moving. It made me feel like I wasn't at risk for DVT, which is like to me is the biggest, other than just the pain you might have from Macerners, the biggest fear is like the risk of or some sort of increased risk or something related to DVTs, right? That just scares me. And those were some of the, what was going through my head. I'm like, should I get a stent, right? Should I still get a stent even though I'm not having pain? Is this really just the most natural, least invasive thing to do before I start pursuing Nutcracker? Anyway, so he goes in there, and I'm just going to tell you what the report said. After the Macerner stuff, he comes up to my left renal vein, and what he sees inside my left renal vein is I'm going to say the word wrong. It's mild sphincteini, and it's spelled sphincteiae. Okay, if you guys can look this up, within the left renal vein at its narrowest component, so where it's compressed the most. This can be from a prior mild DVT or inflammation related to the moderate stenosis of this area. So basically, he'd gone in and there was like remnants of what might have been a DVT there, or just remnants of some extra tissue where I'm most compressed because of the stenosis, because of the inflammation, right? Again, this is just like, it's getting me thinking. I'm like, this is even more proof that I have Nutcracker and this is a problem for me. I'm having like potentially mild DVTs forming in this area because it's so stenosed. I'm also having additional inflammation and excess tissues growing there. Anyways, so it's at this point that he decides to, he's like, I'm going to do this. Like just looking at this, you definitely need it. He knocks me out. They put the balloon in, they blow it up. And on my IVUS, you can actually see all this happening, right? Because there's like videos of this. You can see my little tiny narrow vein getting bigger. And then you can also see the increased blood flow. I think that was something that was so interesting to me. It went from hardly having any blood flow and being very clogged up to like having all this increased blood flow. And it's just a really powerful image for me to watch after the fact when I had my follow-up appointment. So, and Dr. Stertiel went on to tell me, one of the reasons he does this for the right patients is because he actually has a patient that has Nutcracker, and it's milder, I think. And the instead of her going through AT or going through any other surgeries, she just comes in and gets this done whenever things start to kind of flare up or get worse for her. Now, granted, that might just be once a year, maybe once every 2 years, but that this procedure really worked in opening up the vein enough for her so she didn't have pain there anymore. And I thought like, oh my gosh, wouldn't that be amazing if this was the solution for me, if this was the answer. And I didn't need to get AT, right? It just seems like, why wouldn't I try something like this out if the doctor was willing to do it? Now, there are some other studies online that talk about patients who've gotten this done, and actually that like getting this done has actually cured their nutcracker, right? So there are stories like that. Plus, there also are plenty of other stories, probably like similar to mine, where they did this, it helped for a little bit, and then my vein just got re-narrowed again, right? So it just helped for a little bit. And so, was it worth doing it? Yes, it was, because it did help for a little bit. And it also just gave me this like really, gosh, there's so much doubt you have around things like this. I don't think anyone wants to have major surgery like an AT, and like we get so mistreated sometimes in the medical field. With other doctors, this is such an exhausting journey to be on. And wouldn't it be great if I just had something really simple and there was like a way easier fix to this, right? But when I had this test, it really was like the thing that just like 100% gave me clarity that I do have this and I do have to have, like I need to do something about it. And like this, for me, unfortunately, the angioplasty isn't a long-term solution. again, like it is for one of his patients. She does have to go back and get it occasionally. And also there are research studies where it has worked for other people. It seems like, you know, in a permanent way of solving this for certain people. So it just seems like, I think I kind of was like, geez, everyone should just get, if their doctor's willing to do it and it's safe and it aligns with their situation, then everyone should be able to get a balloon angioplasty if they're getting an IVUS done. It's just, it really is. I don't know what the additional risk factors are, so obviously talk to your doctor about that, but it seems pretty minimal. And then it was like, oh my God, I do have this. This is it. And I'm now definitely going to pursue getting surgery for this. And I haven't looked back since. So anyway,
Yeah.
yeah.
No, I, when you told me about this, and then when I went and saw, and I think it's hilarious we're using like Dr. Stradle, however,
I know,
if
I'm
they're listening to this, you're
sorry.
gonna be like, that's not how you say my name. We joke all the time. I'll be like, wait, how do you say his name? When I was telling him about that, about the angioplasty, I, until you told me about it and he had offered that to you and said that it was an option, like the patient that he has come in once every year, every 2 years to do that, to avoid a major surgery, like I absolutely would have looked into that for myself. And for you, we've talked about like on the Marcaine test, on the renal Hiler block, we've talked about the subjectivity of like you doing your own pain log after. And then when you're a chronic pain patient, your 0 to 10 pain scale is a lot different. Your brain neurologically has adjusted to the pain. So we often have a propensity to downgrade the pain, right? Like we might think it's a 3-4 when anybody else that's not a chronic pain patient, that's a 7 to 8 to them. So that's what's hard about the renal Hiler block and the Marcaine test. But when you got the renal angioplasty, I remember, I mean, we talk on a very regular basis. So I was like, tell me about it. What's going on? And when you said, like, gosh, it did give me relief and that gave you the mental clarity to move forward with an auto transplant, it's something I wish I would have known was an option prior. I told Dr. Stradle this. I was like, yeah, if I would have known, had him and known that, I would have pursued it. It still worked out great for me. I got the auto transplant. I'm feeling night and day better. You've seen the difference, right? Like I know the same for you is also going to happen. But I think it's really empowering. Like you don't know what you don't know in the medical community. And even with us in chronic pain, we're brain fog, fatigue, and we're using the like 20, sometimes minimums of 10% of energy we have in a day to try to research what we can. And we're trying to leave no stone unturned. And we're trying to show up to doctor's appointments as informed as we can possibly be. But sometimes we don't even know to look at a particular stone to turn over if nobody's pointing at it. If nobody's saying, hey, let's broaden your peripheral here so you can see that stone. And that's why I was like, oh my gosh, Kat, can we do a podcast episode on the renal angioplasty as an option? I see a lot of people on these Facebook posts, and I want to validate their experience that they want to avoid a major surgery at all costs. Okay, well, let's help them out and let's do them, let them avoid. I, on the other hand, was like, let's jump to like I think I'm a pretty aggressive person when it comes to this stuff. Like I was very much like the moment I started having symptoms, I know my body, something's wrong, let's get this fixed. I jumped straight to the auto transplant because I saw that it had a higher success rate. That's not everybody's cup of tea. That's not everybody's philosophy, and that's okay. So to know that the renal angioplasty is there as an option that they can ask their IR about, if the IR isn't comfortable with it, hey, IR, then who can you refer me to? Help me out here. The
Yeah,
circle's, you know.
why aren't you comfortable with it would be my
Yeah,
question.
dude. Yeah.
This is not, and this is an angioplasty with no stent. I just want to be clear. You know, this is not, sometimes you'll read a lot about balloon angioplasties if you Google it with people getting a stent placed. This is just a balloon angioploplasty, no stent. So it's just ballooning and opening up the space and letting it stay open. I just remember waking up from that IVUS and being pain-free for the first time in that area in over like a year, and how wonderful that felt. I mean, it reminds me of how good I felt after my Marcaine test, and I think that's why I was like, "Yes, I have this." But like, I was crying. My mom was like, "You were crying." It makes me want to cry right now, actually.
Go,
Just,
I feel it.
you know, being in pain for so long, and then when you actually are pain-free for a bit, and you forgot how that even feels like. And then you actually have hope. I like remember feeling like, I wonder if this works. I wonder if this will work for me long term. You know, like if this, what if this is it? And it wasn't, but it's okay. What I will say about it, and what I will say is that it did reduce my pain for a while, and even that was amazing. It made
What a
just that
gift, yeah.
last that period of time so much easier. And then it also, not stressing out anymore about, is this it? Is this not it? Anyway, yeah, it
Yeah.
was that moment is so visceral to me of still in my body that relief I got
Yes.
post that IBS, sitting in that, waking up from in the recovery and just being like, wow,
Yeah.
this is amazing.
Yeah. Well, I remember too, the renal hyaline block did that for me. And something that really was a mind fuck for me is, and I think so many of us in this space, because we're staring down the barrel of a major surgery. And so every molecule of our being is like, we've talked about this. I don't want the surgery. I just want a doctor to tell me, you don't need this. You don't need this. And so that's when I woke up from my stint, and Dr. Spencer was like, oh, I think it's all May Thurner and you're fine. And I don't think nutcrackers, like, yeah, sure, you had a compression, but it's not. And obviously, there was some downplaying there. But with that being said, I remember just being like, oh, thank God, because I just wanted anybody to tell me that I could avoid this surgery and there was a fix that wasn't going to be that major. And so when I woke up from the renal hyaline block, and I had the relief, similar experience that you had with the Marcaine, similar experience you had to the renal angioplasty, was the, oh no, oh no. But then, like with the renal angioplasty, you were like, oh, maybe this is the fix and I can get, like, that's why I wish I would have known it was an option, because it's nice. I do remember it was what, like a couple of days later we chatted and you were kind of in the dumps a little because you were like, oh man, this is coming back. And it really confirmed, like, I need the auto transplant. But with that being said, when the pain went away, another thing it can validated for me though too, it was the mind fuck in that I was like, oh no, I'm gonna have to get this auto transplant. Damn it. Then though, it was so validating because we all have a tendency of downplaying our symptoms of like, oh well, it's like a 3-4. When in reality, when the pain went away and I was pain-free, I was like, this is what normal feels like. This is what the pain. So then I was like, I've been minimizing my pain. My neurologically, I've been adapting to the pain so that I can survive. I'm like, no, this is 7-8 pain I've been dealing with. And it was just so, I remember being very emotional about that. And now post auto transplant, me feeling so much better. I look back and I'm like, I don't know how I did it. Teaching full time, grading 86 to 10 page papers 2 days, but submitted 2 days before my auto transplant. Like, I look back and I'm like, okay,
Crazy.
where's my awards? But I think the renal angioplasty is so, I've talked to other people with Nutcracker. No, you're the first time, Dr. Stradel's the first time I heard anything about this. And I just thought, where, I don't want to, I want to use the word ethics carefully here, but it's just to some extent of, I mean, he's very pro, like trying to avoid the kidney auto transplant. So when I told him, I went and had this done, and he actually fine tooth combed the CT. He did a side by side of my CT, the one I was diagnosed in June, July of 2024 with Nutcracker, to a CT I had a month and a half after my auto transplant. And he fine tooth combed it and showed me how my collateral veins had decreased. They weren't as dilated anymore. So there was a lot of confirmation there of me getting an auto transplant. I mean, my symptoms alone were co are confirmation enough, but it was nice just to see that quantitative data as it was presented on the CT themselves. And then again, him to me going to him, I just felt like a very thorough second opinion. And then the fact that he offered you that renal angioplasty, I just felt like was his way of being like, hey, let's really truly leave no stone unturned. Because if you're somebody who can get away with not needing an auto transplant and just come back yearly, every 2 years to do this, let's do that. If that's what you want to do, right? If you want to opt into that, not everybody, like, I'm very much a like, let's just fix it and move on,
I was different. I was very much like, I mean, I definitely, I'm at the point now where fix it and move on. Like I see the road ahead of me. I'm done. Let's go. But at the time when I went in to see doctors, I actually went in because I had heard he was a little conservative. I was actually looking to see someone who was kind of conservative on this stuff. And so I had wanted that opinion of someone who, was kind of like, It's funny, a surgeon who's not really pro surgeon surgery. It's an interesting contradiction, right? You don't say that. A lot of surgeons just want to do surgery. Not all, not all. But yeah, talking to him about it, I went in there as a naysayer. I said, I don't think anything from my last IVUS is correct. Maybe it was, but I went in there challenging it. I said, I want you to tell me why this is correct or not. I want you to prove it to me. You're a third party coming in. You're not familiar with, you weren't there during this IVUS. Like, do you think this is accurate? Do you think there's a chance it could be different? And if it could be different, can you give me another one? And also, I want to avoid surgery. What can we do to avoid this? And I will note that I did talk to a third IR as well, just to look at my images. I feel like I just have a collection of really good doctors now. But I'm going to do a shout out to Dr. Constantino out of Oregon. Dr. Muldoon had referred me into Dr. Fogelson out of Oregon, who's a specialty vascular gynecological doctor. So he's actually has removed stents for people. I'm just going to put that out there right now. He told me he's done that. So if people are having issues with their stents, he told me he has removed stents. I know that not a lot of doctors do that. Not that there's a high chance you're going to need that done. I don't want anyone freaking out. Obviously, everyone I know who's gotten a stent doesn't regret it, and it has helped them. So, I don't want to like, but if you are someone, he does it. And I talked to him to just have him look at my images to make sure, hey, there was a question. Do I have endo growing in my kidney? Right? Is that why I'm having kidney pain? So I had like a lot of endo surgeons are not authorized to do surgery outside of the pelvic area into you need to get often see a specialty endo surgery to do it into other parts of the area. Dr. Fogelson is one of the few doctors who is also vascular trained, so also does some work with Mace Earners as well. So we were just kind of talking through that, and it was during that process he said you should talk to Dr. Constantino. She's an excellent IR, and she'll look at your images. So, and this is at the same time I had an appointment to see Dr. Shertiel a few weeks later, and so I had had her look at them, and she had just reconfirmed exactly what Dr. Shertiel had said. So it's kind of just nice to, hey, if someone throws a great doctor, in front of you, and you have the means to see them, you have the energy to see them, you have the insurance to see them. Of course, this, not everyone has that, but if you do, and you have, the energy, I think I already said that. That's so important. If you have the bandwidth, the mental bandwidth to see them, then I don't, for me, I was like, let's go. Let's get this third person in that I heard was good. But this is something that she mentioned to me because I did see her after my second IVUS, and I just was like, hey, let's look at it together. She reminds me of Dr. Muldoon a lot. She's really interested in hormones and the interplay of stuff. She's super curious. She spent over an hour and a half with me on the first call, even though it was scheduled for like 20 minutes. She's really interested in why this stuff is happening and the deeper reasons and understanding how the whole body works together. So I just really appreciate talking to a doctor like that. I feel very seen and heard, and I just thought she was extremely intelligent. But anyway, she mentioned to me that angioplasty may or may not be covered by insurance, and so that might be the only reason why a doctor might not do it. And because she's, so I just want to point that out. Maybe if your doctor won't do it, and you ask them why, and they say because I don't think it'll be covered by insurance, then maybe that, maybe that's the reason. I don't know. I think because Dr. Stratil went in there and he saw me, and this is just my guess, he saw what looked like a mild DVT. Maybe that gave him reason to do it, and maybe that's why this isn't used as a common diagnostic test. I mean, to me, this seems like, I'm not a doctor, but I feel like this test is just as good as some of the other diagnostic tests that are used. And if you're already getting an IVUS, I forgot how easy it is that you can get your diagnostic test done at the same exact time, versus having to come back for a hyaluron block or a Marcaine test. But again, there's no research paper saying that this would be a good diagnostic test. But what I'm saying, if there are anyone out there doubt this, who knows, who's researching Nutcracker, who was listening to this podcast, please, it would be great if you did a study on using this as a diagnostic test, or someone considering using this as a diagnostic test. I think it'd be a great one. So,
If I had a dollar for every time one of us said, I'm no doctor. I swear to
anyway.
God. Also, Dr. Muldoon, one time, I loved this. I said that and she goes, listen. Like she almost kind of just challenged me on it. She was like, like sure, you didn't go to med school. Like, but I just really, that's why I was like, this is why you're a good doctor. Because I can get online, I can look at the vascular anatomy. Like I have a pretty good understanding of this stuff, at least to be able to speak about it, where we can collaborate with doctors, where we can be like, hey, like let's come together and be partners in this rather than this kind of like unidirectional top-down power over thing. I think too, that's really good about the insurance thing. I mean, and something if they're like, yeah, insurance won't cover it, like I would come back and say, can we at least try? Right? Like,
Yeah, or also like, can you look to see if there is some scarring inside or what looks like a lot of inflammation or what might have been the remnants of a DVT or anything that would give you reason to be able to bill insurance for it, like justification if they, at least ask for that. I don't know how Dr. Shtil never mentioned anything like that to me, never said he had a question about insurance. This is just what Dr. Constantino shared with me. I don't know if it's relevant or not, but I did want to point it out if people are going to be asking this. So.
Yes, and again, to empower the audience to know what questions to ask. So if somebody said doesn't, if your IR doesn't offer an angioplasty, ask if they will. If they say no, say why.
Why?
Like, why? Yeah. Excuse me, but why not? And if they come back with the insurance thing, just be like, well, can we at least, I would rather try that. Let's see if it'll get pre-authorized, whatever it is. If not, let's do a peer-to-peer review on it. If that's something you really want, again, advocate for what you need and finding an IR. Like I feel like Dr. Stradel is this way of advocating for you. Like he very much seems very humble, very intelligent, very humble, very much an advocate, and very professional. Like I felt like getting the second opinion, it wasn't like, oh, this is everything wrong with your previous IR, but it was more just like, this is what I would suggest looking at your thing. So it's just data that you can then use intuitively to know it's the right direction for you. It sounds like then looking at your story, and kind of thematizing it here is like kind of step one. If you haven't explored endometriosis for yourself, maybe that could be a good place to start if you're really wanting to avoid the Maythorn stent. If you have the means to be able to do that, then moving forward, doing the IVUS. I think something powerful for you was your second IVUS is that you were lightly sedated, but you were awake for it. That's something I
Yeah.
wish I would have known. I didn't even know to be like, can I be awake for this? Like that I had no idea. I wasn't even on the Mayþerner board yet, the Nutcracker board yet at all. I only got on it after my first IBIS. And then your experience, I'm like, gosh, I didn't know I could be empowered in that way. I'm a medical nerd. I love being awake for whatever shit I can be awake for that's not going to just be excruciating. So I think that was really powerful for you to be able to do that. I mean, you were highly complimentary of that. And just being able to ask questions while you're literally in it versus asking
Yes.
after. And there's a vulnerability in when you're fully asleep because you just trust that the doctor's doing what they need to do and you don't really know. And that's another thing going back to Dr. Stradel, the humility in allowing you to almost be there to like to ch not check him like, oh, you're doing that wrong, but like to partner with you in this procedure that your body is going through, like the autonomy that's there is so powerful. The partnership that's there in that happening. So for people to know, ask your IR, like, can I be lightly sedated for this IVUS so you can walk me through what you're doing? If that's something they want to do. Now, some people might not want that, but I think that was really powerful. And then the renal angioplasty is something that you can advocate for to see, like, is that something that does provide relief and potentially longer term relief? So you don't have to have an auto transplant or donate your kidney or a stent or a transposition. Is there anything like any tips or tricks you would advise others to do prior to their IVUS to evoke like the best results? I know in the Markane test we kind of talked about, I joked with my renal hyaline block that I exercised like crazy before and told Kyle to like lock it down with the sex that morning before we went so that I'd be in like major pain. Is that, did you do that for the IVUS? Is that something you would kind of tell people to do or didn't
I
matter?
didn't. I didn't. I was already in quite a bit of pain going into it, and I wasn't told to up it. And like, I at the time like had read some of this. Like I'd read there if on the Facebook page, other people have had balloon angioplasties. I went on there. That search function is so helpful on that page, y'all. If you're not using, I mean, if you're not using that, you definitely get ready for a full day of search fun because you're gonna have so much fun searching stuff. I know that some people have had it on there and they did not get long-term relief from it. So I wasn't going into it, I was just kind of like excited to get the second opinion. And I think I just kind of went in there with, yep, here we go, just another procedure type mindset. So I didn't do anything to flare it up. I did want to note there was something important that I forgot to mention. Is it okay if I mention it right now?
Yeah,
Like,
absolutely.
two different things. One is my first itis was jugular. They came in through my neck, probably because I don't know why you would do that, but that could be, you know, she wanted to come in jugular. My second one was femoral. And obviously, you know, if you're getting a stent, they're going to need to come in femorally because it's just too big to insert jugularly. There's just too many complications. But I will say that between the two, I noticed zero difference. So I know some people have asked, like, is, and again, that's just my take on it. But I mean, in terms of recovery from it, I didn't notice any sort of difference between the two. It healed around the same time. And, you know, the only difference is if you get it jugularly, you can go straight in the hot tub that day. You get it
Yeah.
femorally, you're out of the hot tub for a few days. Okay. Like, I mean, to me, I don't know, you know, there's obviously reasons to get it in one spot or the other. Like, if you're getting the stent, if you need the stent, good for you. So happy for you. And, you know, the other thing I wanted to mention was just about what was left over in terms of my side effects was my left leg still like being more swollen and my legs hurting. And Simone, you had said, you know, have you gotten an ultrasound done on your legs to see if they were varicose? And I said, I haven't. So I went and got that done. And I mean, I think that's just like something that everyone, this is just another thing. It's just, everyone should do this. This should just be like a standard checklist thing. But I did have reflux. They only checked my left leg at the place I went to because that was the one I said, oh, you know, my right leg hurt too. They did check part of my right leg, actually, now that I'm thinking about it. But they said, hey, your left leg is really varicose. Like your great saphenous vein is completely shot. You need to get that ablated. And I said, you know, can that come from Mathurner's? Yeah. Can it come from Nutcracker? Yeah. And then also, it can also just come from being a 43-year-old woman who's had multiple kids or just lived a life, right? It could just also be genetics. It could just be this runs in your family. It doesn't have to be related to anything else. And I did get a second opinion on my legs done at Dr. Shirtiel's office. And they determined, yeah, you need both your legs done. They're refluxing. Stasis in some of them, your veins over 5 seconds in some of them. For this is GSV, great saphenous veins for ablation. I haven't had that procedure yet, not because I don't want to, just because y'all know it's like surgery games, right? Yeah. Like it's like freaking Olympic medal going on here. It's like I got to schedule my surgeries out in a certain way, with a certain amount of
Yeah,
time.
what should be first?
Yeah, what should be first? What order do you do them in? You know, there's this idea, of course, I talked to UC Health about this and they said, you might not need to have your GSVs ablated after nutcracker surgery. Dear God, if I hold on to, I do, I hold on to those things. I'm like, maybe that's true. Maybe that's true, you know? So we'll see how I'm doing. But anyway, I just wanted to throw out, like, I did run down the leg thing. Like, why were my legs hurting? And I figured out what. I got it approved from insurance and I just haven't moved forward with it yet because of
Well,
timing. So,
and that's I'm glad you brought this up because when I had venous insufficiency in both of my legs, worse in my left. When I got the stent done, I was still having left leg pain and went back and got my ultrasound redone. And I just love collecting data. I mean, maybe that's the researcher in me. So I go have my legs redone because I also at the time I was semi looking into tethered cord. That candle kind of burned out a little bit. Because the auto transplant took the front burner. So I go get my legs re-ultrasound so that I could let the kind of like let insurance know and let the doctors know, hey, it isn't actually the venous stuff anymore. And that came back like my venous insufficiency wasn't as bad. So it really actually showed me that the stent did help me so much. Now, I'm still having left leg pain. I was like, well, maybe this is Nutcracker related. It went away for a while. It's coming back now. I don't know. I think looking like I'm still kind of, as you know, I'm just left the cardiologist this morning. Thankfully, we don't think it's POTS, but we'll see. MCAs, I don't know if that's it involves. It could just be my piriformis muscle that I need to, you know, from sitting a lot of the day. It's hard to know. And everything with vascular compressions, it's a whole body thing. Like, again, with my nutcracker, I was having musculoskeletal issues, pulmonary embolism symptoms, headaches, and they all felt very separate from each other. But then I go have the surgery and they're all gone. You know, like my POTS-like symptoms are pretty good. My MCAs are are down. Like, it's wild, but you're going seeing all these different specialists. And so, like, the leg thing, it's for you. I remember us chatting about, like, what do you do first? And so I think some of it is, well, let me go fix the vascular compressions to see if the legs get better and I can avoid having to get that procedure. And that's, I think, what we're all hoping for is, can we avoid something? Can we avoid the major surgery? Can we avoid anything? That'd be great.
I feel like I'm in a relay race that never ends. Like, and like all the people in the race are me, and I'm just like passing off the baton from one surgery to the next. Like, that is the visual in my head. And I'm just like, when can I just graduate from this race? When will this
Yes.
relay stop? I hope this is the last baton test, but if it's not, I mean, I do have a set, I have an unrelated surgery coming up this, I already have my next 6 month surgery scheduled, y'all, after this one. I have my AT, and then I have another surgery 6 months out on my cervical spine, dealing with some issues and my up at C5, C6. Anyway, my heart goes out to everyone, you, me,
Yeah, all of us. I
yeah.
know. That's why I'm on antidepressants, what you just said. Like, I'm trying every baton toss, I got more depressed and more depressed. I was like, I think I need to be on a little bit of medical help here, medicine. But thank you so much. Is there any kind of like last minute
No,
thing? Bill,
no, no.
this was wonderful. Thank you for adding value again. I'm sure I'll have you on for like once your auto transplant. We kind of chatted about talking about the differences with your robotic surgery versus my open abdominal. So
Yeah,
I'm sure
and
you'll be back
also,
on at some point.
I'm a little obsessed. Oh, people can't see, but yeah, this is my
She's
standard.
holding. She's holding up a bunch of research papers that are about that are it's just a thick stack of paper clipped research papers. Yeah. I can
Yeah.
always you're the person I always call and I'm like, what's new? And you give
Yeah.
me the
And
cliff notes.
I've like, I'll read all the new research. I buy it often, but yeah, I'm preparing for my AT, and I have written a 4-page plan, in intraoperative plan for me to understand what's going to be happening piece to piece. And also, really interested in the pain management side of this. And all I've researched all the different pain management options and read papers on them. And also, I'm just gonna say, very interested in ERA stuff, which is enhanced recovery after surgery. And what I've been doing is I've been using the research on nephrectomies and on kidney transplants, because there is no research on an auto transplant for this stuff, but there are a lot of ERAs research on nephrectomies and on kidney transplants again. So I don't know, we'll see how it goes. I am fully preparing to. God, I mean, I'd love to do just an episode. Anyway, I'm just gonna say, I'd love to do an
Yeah,
episode
we're queuing
after
up a pain management
AT
episode recording. I love
and
this.
eras, using
Well,
eras to feel better.
that's what's been beautiful about this podcast is I really didn't start out. I mean, I knew I was going to share my lived experience with like these procedures and like the auto transplant, my nutcracker journey. And then it got to a point where I was like, okay, I shared everything I know. And it's been such a like, the episode, all of a sudden I'll be on the renal nutcracker page. And I just recorded the mast cell activation syndrome episode that'll go live soon. And that was just off of I had a beautiful conversation with this woman named Lily. And I was like, hey, do you want to be on an episode? Like, that's been what's really fun about the artistic nature of this is these episodes have been creating themselves. And so I'm excited to see where this goes. I've been excited for you to be a part of the journey in more
Thank
ways
you.
than one, as a really good friend, but also as somebody who's adding value to this podcast. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for giving me a platform to share my story. I do think that sharing your story is incredibly cathartic and healing, and especially after you've gone through it. It's a way of like processing and saying, I've done this, it's over. And also a way of saying, like, I conquered that in a way. Like, I have taken it, I have run it through my brain multiple times, and now I'm succinctly sharing it, and it's in the past. And there's like some sort of level of like, I'm not an expert in this, but I'm an expert in my own story. And there's something about owning your story. And so even if you're not on this podcast, even if, you're in the middle of this, like I am, I'm really in the middle, I do think there's so much value in sharing your story in a safe place with other people, and processing and knowing, like, hey, I went through this. I'm a badass. Like, or that was really traumatic and scary, and I hated it, and I'm through it now. It's over, and I did it. And there's something about the sharing of it in past tense, at least, that I found is really helpful for my brain. So anyway, thank you for having me on, because I This is like therapy to me. This is like healing to
Yeah.
me. I appreciate
I
it.
love this. I love this. No, this is great. Well, thank you so much, Kat. Thank you everybody for listening to this episode. If you have any you hear this story, drop a comment on this episode just to continue the conversation if you want, if you have questions, things of that nature. So again, this podcast is just here to start a conversation, to get stories out there, to make you not feel so alone. So thank you all for listening.